Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 263, featuring Wael Abdelmajid, who is absolutely incredible. I met him. We were both on a panel for the SAG-AFTRA conference that was happening during CES in Vegas. And we were both talking about digital humans, more specifically about deepfakes. This was a concern of SAG-AFTRA. And I just connected with him so well that I said, you have to be on the podcast. He is a machine learning scientist. He's at ISI or USC. He does some really amazing work in the area of deep fakes. Now, keep in mind, he's not actually a computer graphics person. He's a computer vision person. And that's kind of a distinction that he makes. What are some of the things, Kristen, that you took away from this? This was a pretty heady conversation, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it was, I know deepfakes, but like, I was like, ooh, dang, I didn't right. know as much. But yeah, it got out of it. Like, they're not all bad and they're not all good, but I guess they're becoming easier and easier to recreate, which I didn't know.
Yes, that's true. And he makes a point about that. He basically says that deepfakes at their core are not bad. Mm-hmm. What you do with them can be bad or be good. It just depends on this use case. So he makes a real point about that, which I think is interesting. Mm-hmm. And then what are some of the other things you...
Well, so he's developing like advanced techniques to detect all these suspicious videos. And
right.
he kept talking about like spam, like the filter almost, right. like to detect in that
yeah.
way.
Yeah. So the same way that you would basically use a spam filter to detect spam in your email, you basically is creating a tool for videos for you to detect if something is possibly a deepfake. And again, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad thing. It's mm-hmm. just you being able to identify if it's real or not real is just giving him that tool to do that, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. And then he also said it's detecting lying is easier than detecting deep fakes, which is
right.
I was like, whoa. And you guys mentioned the funny Seinfeld episode for that as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating conversation. I just really, really loved having him on. I was really blown away by this stuff. And I think obviously the conversation about deepfakes is very important. We start to get a little bit into the politics of it, as it is so important this year and election year to understand what a deepfake is, that it's possible, and just educating ourselves on this subject. So hopefully this podcast will be useful for all of you guys. All right, Kristen, let's get on to some events.
All right. So you can find all of our events at chaosgroup.com/events. And we've been talking about this for a while, but we have Total Chaos coming up on May 29th to 31st. And you can find all the information about this at chaosgroup.com/totalchaos.
And absolutely remember, guys, that actually we're actually getting dangerously low on tickets. So this may actually sell out. So if you're thinking about going and you're thinking you're just going to buy a ticket at the last minute, I would avoid doing that in case we do sell out. So go ahead and get your ticket now if you can, because it's that day's coming up quick and we are probably going to run out of tickets. So go ahead and do that. What else is new?
All right. So I've talked about this last few weeks, but we have a new transcript page up. So if you want to read any of these podcasts, you can go to the podcast page and click the transcript button.
Yeah, and absolutely. And this one actually would be a useful one to have as a transcript mm-hmm. because there's a lot of information in there.
Yes.
Cool. And where can people find out the podcast?
So you can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast.
Or
chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And if you guys have any ideas or would like to talk about things that you want to hear on a podcast or feedback or anything or people you'd like to have on, feel free to reach out to us, labs@chaosgroup.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions and your feedback. And remember, we always appreciate any kind of sharing and or reviews that you can give us on Apple Podcasts. It's always very useful to us. So if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, don't forget to give us a rating, a review, and share it with all your friends. All right. Thanks, guys. That said, please enjoy episode number 263 with Wael Abdelmajid.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're going to fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
All right. Wael, right?
Wael.
Wael.
Yes.
Wael.
It's like two syllables with a glottal stop in the middle.
Wael.
Perfect.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I don't know if you know this, but I was born in Cairo.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm
What's the backstory?
What's the backstory? Okay. My father was the business manager for the American University in Cairo.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I lived in Garden City.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
For how long?
Oh, till I was six. So
oh,
from,
wow.
from birth till I was 6 years old. And I went to the Franciscan nuns school.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in Garden City.
Uh-huh.
And then, yeah, it was.
Wow, this is such a small world.
I know. I loved it. It was fun. It was in the 70s, so yeah. During Sadat years. So
yeah,
it was very different. But so anyway, so you're Egyptian, I'm assuming, or you're from Egypt, right?
Egyptian-American now.
Egyptian-American,
yes, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's where you grew up and that's where you went to school, right?
Not in Cairo. After I graduated college, I moved to Cairo to work in Cairo. But I actually originally from a smaller city between Cairo and Alexandria. It's called Mansoura.
Mansoura, okay.
Yeah. So, but after I finished college, I moved to Cairo to work in Cairo.
Oh, okay. And then what got you to move to the United States? More education?
Well, I didn't actually move to the United States from Egypt right away. I moved to Canada first. I used to be a software engineer in Toronto.
Oh, okay.
And then a good friend of mine convinced me to go back to the academia. Industry is not for you. And he convinced me to move to the United States to go to grad school.
Grad school, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so where you went to New Mexico, right?
I first went to UNR, University of Nevada at Reno.
Oh, okay.
The department was too small. I didn't really like the research problem I was giving.
Right.
So I decided to apply again about a year and a half later or something. And then I moved to University of New Mexico in Albuquerque.
In Albuquerque, all right. Yes. My dad lives in Albuquerque.
Oh,
it's really nice. Yeah.
It's a nice city, yeah.
It's a nice city. I like it. It's a really kind of an interesting, very creative place.
Yes, yes. Very small. You only have the university. You have Sandia National Labs.
Yep.
The Air Force Base, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah. But it's really a lot of really very smart people live in New Mexico in that
yes,
area.
That's true.
So you were always focused in computer graphics, and if some level or as a developer. Or?
I am not actually a computer graphics person. I'm a computer vision person.
Yes,
which is pretty much the inverse of computer graphics.
Right.
Computer graphics people
create things,
and we do exactly the opposite. We actually take videos and images and try to understand them.
Right.
So that's what I have been doing since I graduated college. Try to make sense out of images.
Right.
And pixels.
Okay. And so what are some of the applications that you could be using for computer vision? Obviously, things like autonomous driving is a big thing now. Obviously, with Teslas, it's all computer vision based, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And
so,
detecting things,
basically trying to understand visual information, trying to understand images and videos.
Right.
And over the last 6 years or something since I joined USC, we have been focused on basically two big areas. One of them is biometrics, including faces, face recognition, making biometric systems more secure, including fingerprint scanners, iris scanners, and face recognition systems.
Yeah.
So this is one big area. And then the other area, which you and I discussed a couple of weeks ago, is multimedia forensics.
Right.
Can you look at an image or a video and say whether this piece of media is manipulated or altered or not?
Right.
Yeah.
And that is a fascinating field, understanding how data manipulation can happen on images, and obviously something very important. We should sort of clarify what we were on a panel for. So we were both on a panel for the SAG-AFTRA that was happening during CES in Vegas. ironically, a place with a lot of fake stuff going on.
Yes,
but also the big thing there was obviously detecting if digital humans or a video that would be out there would be faked, right?
Correct.
And so deep fakes was a big part of that discussion that we were looking at. Mm-hmm. Obviously. Well, I think it would be really great from your point of view if you could help, you know, people listening to understand what how there's a lot of people that are using deepfakes in a very broad way. Mm-hmm. But what would be a good way to describe, okay, here's what is a deepfake? Like what could you actually describe as a deepfake in a more analytical way?
Well, in a nutshell, a deepfake is basically a video for a person, mm-hmm. right? And that video is not real.
Right.
It's actually created by a deep neural network. This is where it's not real. That's where the word fake comes right. from. And it's created by a deep neural network. This is where the word deep comes from.
Right.
That's why we have deep fakes.
Right.
And there is a lot of methods for creating these deep fakes.
Right.
Some of them are graphics-based methods. Some of them are just hardcore neural network.
Right.
Bottom line is that what you see is not real.
Right.
This person didn't actually say this.
Right.
You basically created him.
Right.
And as I probably told you on the panel, deepfakes are not all created equally, meaning they're not all bad and they are not all good.
Right.
Deepfakes have existed in Hollywood's for, I don't know, 50 years now.
Right.
Or maybe even more. I'm not an expert in Hollywood history.
Right.
But people in Hollywood have created deepfakes or fakes for a really long time.
Right.
The problem now is that deepfakes are becoming really easy to create.
Right.
With just a piece of software you download from an open source portal like GitHub or something, and literally in your basement, if you have a nice computer, a couple of $1,000 worth of computer,
right,
you can create a deepfake.
Right. So what is the big thing? Because right now the software that a lot of people are using to create these deep fakes that are becoming very popular on the internet are the ideas of, you know, making someone, shifting someone's face to look like someone else.
Correct.
Right? Mm-hmm. So the idea is that someone is acting out, pretending to be another person, mm-hmm. and then they used a deep fake as a mask mm-hmm. of that person mm-hmm. to look like the actual person that they're
yes.
doing, right?
Yeah.
So that's mm-hmm. that's the scary part, because if you can act like
correct.
Someone, then you can make that person actually look like that person.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. And that is a little, obviously, that's been an issue because a lot of people are saying you can fake someone's performance or whatever they're doing. So this actually has implications both on the in terms of people's rights of what they're saying mm-hmm. correctly, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, creating fake news was another big issue,
yes.
right?
Yes.
So because you're in computer vision, and I'm assuming that a lot of the things you're doing is actually your role is to detect whether that's being done or not, right?
Correct. Correct. Yes. So what we have been doing for the last year and a half now is trying to figure out, given a video, can we say that this is actually fake or not?
Right.
And the focus, at least on my group, is to try to mitigate all the problems that come that comes with deepfakes in terms of fake news and misinformation.
Right.
The problem is not just creating one single deepfake video. If you put, if you have a single deepfake video, it's not a big deal.
Okay.
The problem is that when you put a deepfake video on a social network like Twitter and Facebook, and
right.
it goes viral,
right.
that is really problematic. So we have been focused on that for the last year and a half on basically detecting these deepfakes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the tools that you guys are creating are to help prevent that from ever happening in the first place, right?
I can't really say we will prevent that from ever happening because like any machine learning or artificial intelligence tool,
right.
we will make mistakes. We will miss some deep fakes.
Right.
And we will say that some authentic videos, we will say that these are actually fakes.
False
but
positives.
Exactly.
Right.
False positives and false negatives.
Right.
Exactly. So what we're trying to do is just make the problem a little bit easier. We were creating a tool that you can use to analyze a video Right. And you make up your own mind whether the evidence that we provide to you makes sense or not.
Okay. Yeah. So, but that is actually an issue that's a very interesting one, because I was thinking about during our panel when you were talking about it, is we have tools, for example, constantly that help us with issues like this. Like, for example, you could almost talk about spam emails, right? Right? You have a series of emails that come through. And if I go through my spam folder right now, it is filled with bad emails that I don't want, right? Correct. Things that are misinformation emails or selling me things I don't want or whatever, you know, I am the Prince of Algeria and I need all this money, you know, the classic spam problem, right? Mm-hmm. But my spam filter detects that and puts it into a spam folder to identify that as fake. I can still go to that folder and see whether there are emails that I may have received, which happens, emails that I may have received that were not spam, but were identified as spam.
Correct.
Right? So in a sense, you're creating a spam folder for deepfakes. In a sense.
Correct. Yes. This is actually a great analogy. That's pretty much what we're trying to do.
Right.
But if you remember many, many years ago or 20 years ago or something, spam filters were really sort of naive and they didn't really work well. So at least 20 years ago or 15 years ago, we didn't really trust spam filters.
Right.
You couldn't really have trusted a spam filter to take an email that arrives to you, take it right away and just hide it from you. You didn't want that.
Right.
So maybe 15 years ago, what we really wanted is something that gives us a label or some indication that a given email is spam.
Right.
Now, with the technology that has matured for spam filtering over the last 20 years, machine learning, etc., you can actually trust these spam folders, spam filters.
Right.
This is where we are. Where we are now in terms of deepfake detection is where spam filtering was 15 years ago.
Okay.
That's why we don't want to make decisions and on behalf of people. We don't want to say, no, I'm not going to show you this on Facebook or Twitter because we think that this is fake. We just want to say, be careful. Think about what you're seeing now.
Possible spam.
Possible spam or possible deepfake
right.
before you actually reshare it because it might be problematic.
Okay. Yeah. So are these tools that you guys are creating, are these tools that are specifically being given to people in the social media area? Are there people in the social, like the Facebooks and the Twitters, are they using these tools to help them? Because this is obviously becoming a problem in some ways, right?
So my group, we work for academia. We work for a university. So our research is public. The first generation of the detector that we created 6 or 7 months ago has been publicly released. The paper is public. Anybody can actually implement the software if he wants.
Right.
Nobody approached us from Facebook or Twitter to actually use our software. We will be more than happy to share the code with the social network platforms if they actually want to do something quote unquote serious about fighting deepfakes.
Right.
But that hasn't happened yet. In the meantime, we don't want to share our code publicly on GitHub or something because people who actually create deepfakes can take our software and improve their deepfakes to fool our software.
Right.
So it's a cat and mouse game. It's something that will be there in the community for a really long time.
Okay. Well, that's actually a good point because I think that people obviously do that. Like, for example, in spam detection, there was weird emails that looked like they were a long email and they would write all kinds of garbage in there just to fool the spam filter so it would come out of it, right?
Yes.
So they knew how the system worked and you have to, it's like you said, a cat and mouse game.
Correct.
So that's interesting. Okay, so now that we have this idea of like understanding how deepfakes, what are some of the things that you can do that you can talk about that help detect whether something is fake or not? How do you train the system?
We train the system with large amounts of deepfake and authentic videos.
Okay.
Right? This is this is basically sort of not just for deepfake detection. It's sort of the fundamental idea behind deep neural networks.
Right. You're using almost the same kinds of tools to create them, to detect them.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's exactly it. And this is not just in for deepfakes. This is pretty much a common theme for everybody who does deep neural networks or artificial intelligence these days.
Right.
We all use exactly the same tools.
Right.
It's think of it like a Lego. A box of Legos.
Okay.
And we're trying to put together the Legos in a certain way to enable us or help us detect deepfakes.
Okay.
People who create deepfakes use exactly the same box of Legos, just they put it in a different way, different kind of combinations to create deepfakes.
Interesting.
So what we do is we try to sort of capitalize on our experience for the last 6 years in terms of face recognition, etc., because we had another large project for face recognition. Mm-hmm. And under that project, we created a whole bunch of tools for example, face detection.
Okay.
From videos, for landmark detection, finding eyes, mouth, nose, and the boundary of the face, etc. So we had a whole bunch of... Think of it as a toolbox.
Okay.
And we're trying to use this toolbox to help us detect deepfakes.
Okay.
So what we do is detect the face in each frame of the video, detect the landmarks, and in order to sort of minimize the effect of head motion, we use these landmarks in each one of these of the video frames to align all the faces on top of each other.
Okay.
So literally, you look at the face and you... of course, that's not...
You're basically isolating the face.
We're isolating the face, right. And we're trying to minimize the head motion. So after we align all the faces or the face of the same person in all frames on top of each other, it appears as if the face is not moving. Only the eyes and mouth are moving.
Okay.
And now, instead of looking at each one of these frames independently to try to figure out if the video is fake or not, we look at the whole video as a three-dimensional cube of data in time.
Okay.
So we try to find inconsistencies or incoherencies in terms of how the face looks. For example, is the same area of the face, is the texture of the same area of the face consistent between frames or not? Does the mouth and eyes move in sort of a coherent way or not?
Okay.
Because you cannot see in two consecutive frames or a few frames in between or something, if the eyes is open, it will not be closed very quickly.
Okay, you're right.
So we sort of look for these inconsistencies through time to figure out if a given video is manipulated or not.
Okay. So one thing I also thought was interesting is if you look at, so the way that some of these deepfakes work, let's say you're like the famous control shift face videos which are very good. Mm-hmm. Those are the incredibly rich deepfakes where they basically took like Bill Hader and they made him look like Tom Cruise, right? Mm-hmm. So that's it's a very good example of a deepfake. Yes. And a very successful one. But correct me if I'm wrong, but the way that they're doing it is they're not actually pasting Tom Cruise's face onto Bill Hader. They're morphing Bill Hader's face to the features, mm-hmm, of Tom Cruise. Is that a better accurate description of it?
For that video, yes.
Okay.
But generally speaking, there are basically sort of, if you will, two big families of methods for creating these deepfakes.
Okay.
One of them is, let's use the Obama video, the very famous Jordan Peele Obama video.
Yes.
So
that one's about mouth manipulation.
Exactly. So right. So basically what happened is that this is an original Obama video, except that they sort of transferred the facial expressions from Jordan Peele's video,
right?
Right, into Obama's face. So that's still Obama's face. They literally just altered the way he moves his mouth and eyes. Maybe just even mouth.
It's puppeteering almost.
Right? Exactly, right. Yes. And this is called face reenactment.
Right.
Where That is actually an Obama video, except that you transfer the expressions or the facial expressions from one video to the other, which is from Jordan Peele's video into Obama's video.
Right.
So this is one family of sort of algorithms that create deepfakes.
Right.
The other family of algorithms were, for example, the famous Jennifer Lawrence video.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. This is basically somebody took somebody else's face. I can't remember who was the source of the manipulation.
Okay.
And literally replaced Jennifer Lawrence's video.
Okay.
Jennifer Lawrence's face in the video.
Right.
Right. So these are the two big families of methods that for creating deepfakes.
Right.
Right. And both are equally hard to detect.
Okay, but don't you when you're changing the way that Obama's lips move to match the lip syncing of the audio, mm-hmm. or you're changing, Jennifer Lawrence, or you're doing the Tom Cruise one, aren't you stretching and compressing pixels in order to make that happen?
Correct. Right? Correct. But just for clarification, you are not changing Obama's lip movement to match the audio. You're changing Obama's lip movement to match Jordan Peele's lip movements.
Right.
Which in turn basically follow Jordan Peele's audio.
Right.
So it's not, this is what makes it sort of easier, if you will.
Okay.
Because you're not tracking the audio, you're actually just transferring facial expressions and lip movements from one video to the other.
Okay.
Right.
But they're stretching and compressing. Is that something you can detect? Is
That's exactly what we're trying to find.
Right.
There will be stretching and compression, and there will be inconsistencies in each frame and throughout the video.
Right.
Is this something that people who create deepfakes are going to solve? I think so. They will. And they will keep improving their methods, and we keep improving our methods. That's why, as I mentioned on the panel,
right.
it's an arms race.
This is for
people who will be listening to us. This is very similar to what has been happening in computers for the last 50 years in terms of viruses, yep. antiviruses. People create viruses and other people create antiviruses.
Right.
That's sometimes
it's the same people.
exactly. You can play both teams, the virus and the antidote at the same time. you can play both teams.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is actually something that's very interesting. I mean, that could technically be something that someone was like, I've created a deepfake and I've created something that can detect that it's deepfake in some ways, right?
Correct, yeah.
Right.
Well, technically, yes. I have a big ethical issue with this.
Right,
because as I mentioned earlier, I am not a person who basically says deepfakes are all bad. That's not true.
Nope.
I gave an example on the panel. After Paul Walker died, the studio, I think, spent like $50 million to recreate him.
Right.
So the deepfake creation technology will significantly cut these costs. So
sure.
That's a good use of deepfakes.
Okay.
Right? In the meantime, detecting deepfakes is also important because you need to fight misinformation and fake news, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
My problem is that you cannot play both teams. You have to stick with one team. You cannot have your cake and eat it too, if you
will. Right, yeah. Absolutely. I think, but there is, okay, so then it becomes a much more of an ethical question, right? What is allowable and what's not allowable, right? If you're trying to spread misinformation, then you'd have to classify, well, what is misinformation and what is entertainment, right?
Correct.
So, obviously the Corridor Crew guys, you know, they famously made a video of them pretending to have Tom Cruise coming to visit them at their office, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so what they did in that video, and I talked to Nico about it. It was very interesting. It's like, he says, I want to see if we could do this. So the video is about them showing if it's possible or not. They're not actually trying to fool you.
Yes.
Right? They were trying to show you if they can do it. And in the video, just to give a better description of it, is basically they met a guy who does a very good Tom Cruise impression. He came by the office pretending to be Tom Cruise as an impressionist. Mm-hmm. But then they helped his impression by actually making his face look like Tom Cruise in some ways, right?
Yes.
So this was shown to you as this is fake and isn't it funny, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Right. So I think that while it's entertaining to see that in some way, it also helps to let people know that this is possible. So it's part of educating people that it's possible.
Correct.
And therefore, that is almost more valuable than like in, than knowing it. So for example, I've been getting spam emails for years to the point where if something comes through, you know, is a false negative that comes into my inbox, I'll say that's probably spam and I can tag it as spam, right?
Yes.
So by that's because I've had years of my own deep fake deep learning of this process that I can detect that. So do you think that that's also part of a responsibility that we have is to actually show people deep fakes so that they can identify them, and when some deep fake arrives, it's like that's probably fake, right?
I 100% agree with you. I think really the fight against misinformation, not just deep fakes,
right,
does not just involve people who do who work in entertainment or people who create technology like myself and my group. I think it's a much bigger responsibility than just one entity or one group.
Right.
As I like the example that you said, we can create these to educate the public.
So right.
This is one team of people who actually can do this.
Right.
In the meantime, people like myself need to continue developing algorithms and technology to actually detect these deepfakes automatically.
Yes.
In the meantime, there is a big responsibility on the shoulders of social network platforms. Because think about it this way. I can create an educational deepfake video.
Sure.
Right? Post it on my Facebook or Twitter page and clearly say that this is a deepfake. It's meant for entertainment, et cetera, et cetera. Very similar to the Obama, Obama video.
Right? Right, yeah.
But a bad actor will take the video, repost it on his Twitter feed, right? Without saying that this is actually a deep fake that's meant for education or entertainment,
right?
And use it for misinformation.
Right.
So this is where a responsibility on the shoulders of social network platforms come because they can actually use their existing technology to sort of fingerprint their videos and say, yeah, this is the source of that video. It was not, this is not original or this is not authentic. This is where it came from, and it was meant for educational or entertainment purposes.
Right.
So, and of course, the school system, parenting, misinformation in general is a really big problem, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to that problem.
But for example, like the social network, let's say Facebook uses a system like the one that you have to detect things, they could automatically put a tag on that post saying, this video is faked,
yes.
Right? The video can still play.
Yes.
You can still watch it.
Yes.
Whether it's educational or intended to try to manipulation. But if it has that tag, you're going to immediately question it. So it will actually serve both purposes, right?
100% agree.
Right.
And I totally understand that social network platforms do not want to really get involved in that battle. I get it. I'm not going to take hard stances against anybody.
Right.
But you don't even, the social network, Facebook, for example, do not really have to say this is fake. Just show me a bar from 0 to 100 or 1 or 0 to 1 showing how much confident the social network platform is in terms of the authenticity of that video.
Okay.
Show me something and make me make my mind.
Right.
Right. You don't have to say this is fake. You don't have to take a given stance one way or the other.
Right.
Just give me tools to make up my own mind.
Right.
Or you know what? It could be even easier than this. You don't have to say anything. The social network platform doesn't have to give me anything.
Okay.
But give me the capability to right click the video, submit it to a service, and that service will tell me whether how much are we confident in terms of the authenticity of that video. Just give me tools to study a video or investigate a video.
But I don't think people will be – I think that a lot of people don't especially in social networks, there we know this for a fact. People are not doubting what they're getting as much,
agreed,
right?
Yeah.
They just assume it's on the internet and it must be real, which is the stupidest thing.
I 100% agree. And that actually is sort of magnified by what I like to call the echo chamber.
Okay.
My friends on Twitter or Facebook will have exactly the same political views and social views like me. So I tend to believe anything they post,
right,
without actually thinking about it, and I would probably reshare it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I know when someone sends a news article, for example, that doesn't seem authentic to me, and if I call it out, it's like, I don't know if that's real, or I say, you know, that's not real. It's been well misproven. People get really angry at you for correcting them.
Yes, for doubting them. How come you doubt me?
Right.
Yeah. While
you're saying that I'm stupid because I didn't do the research to actually look for that information, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. It's not good, and it's not helping the situation by basically ignoring that post and saying, well, I shouldn't say anything because I don't want to hurt that person's feeling, is actually dangerous too, because it helps propagate it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Staying silent is not an option anymore.
Right.
In this day and age where...
I was actually insulted once. I was saying, it's like, you don't... I was like, I don't want you to be the internet police on me. I was like, well, someone has to be.
Yeah, exactly. We actually have to be policing each other, because this is the fundamental concept of social networks.
Right.
There is no big brother. We are all big brothers on top of each other. So when I see a piece of fake news that you're posting on your Twitter feed or something,
right,
I have to say something. Otherwise, if it goes viral, it's a really big problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you said that, because it's very interesting. Now, I do want to talk about you, because we mentioned that you know Ahau as well at ICT,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And so it's interesting the kind of duality that you play with him, because he actually creates a lot of it.
Correct.
And so tell me about how you guys work together or work with each other in some ways.
Yeah,
right?
Hau is a good friend of mine, but we come from different backgrounds. Hau came from the graphics background.
Right, the creation.
The creation, exactly. Right. And he has a lot of experience with working with Hollywood through ICT or computer science at USC, or even his pin screen company.
Right.
I came from a vision background where I take videos and images and try to make sense of them, try to understand what's in there.
Right.
So but again, as I mentioned, not all defects are created equally. Hau is using his skills and expertise to create technology that helps studios to create digital humans, etc., for good uses. I come from a background where I try to fight fake news and misinformation.
Right.
But we have this duality. It has been nice.
Well, both of you are trying to create awareness of this situation,
correct,
right?
Yes.
Correct. So I thought it was fascinating. I just saw a post that he put out. I guess they made a big display at Davos.
At Davos.
Right?
Hau is at Davos this week.
Yes. Yeah. So he's at Davos this week showing off, and he's basically showing here's a deep fake. So this is bringing awareness to a much bigger platform of people,
correct,
to know about this stuff.
And I'm glad that Hau is taking this stance, because he, as you mentioned, Hau creates these deep fakes for good uses, for Hollywood, for digital humans, for privacy, etc. So when awareness comes from people who actually create these deep fakes, that's a good thing.
Right.
Because if I keep talking about my own research and my technology this is important, I might not be as credible as people who actually create this technology and these deep fakes, and say, be careful. This has to be used with a grain of salt.
Right.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to bring that up. I want to go a quick tangent, because we talked about this briefly as well. I mean, there's lots of different ways that you can try to use for detection purposes, or strategies that you can use for detection purposes.
Correct.
What you mentioned more specifically is about you isolating the face and creating that, right?
Correct.
There was another, and I forgot her name, unfortunately, that I saw her a similar panel about deepfakes, and her detection is about the reverse. She's looking at disjunction between the face and the hands, or the gestures that are going on. There's a different type of technique that she uses.
Correct. Yeah.
Right.
This is I think you're referring to the work that came from my friend's team in Berkeley, Hani Farid's team.
Yes.
So his student, I can't remember her name now, but yes, you're right. She's trying to sort of model facial expressions, audio features, I think also hand gestures or something, if I remember correctly, for each individual
person.
Right.
So if you're, let's take like, you know, Donald Trump or Nancy Pelosi, for example, right? So they train the system to learn how that person would actually work. So when she says a word, does the hand do a specific thing or right?
Yes, because I think even in their paper, they showed that politicians, for example, Obama, he tends to move his head in a certain way when he says specific words.
Right.
So if there is inconsistency between how the head moves and what he's actually saying, this is an indication that the video is manipulated or fake.
Right, which is a pretty interesting approach.
Yes.
But the problem is that it only works for that one person. You're training one person at a time, right?
Exactly. So, and I'm glad you mentioned that. And my good friend Hani Farid from Berkeley agrees. He's actually the lead, one of the group leader on that. And he agrees that this is a shortcoming of their approach. It doesn't scale to a large number of people. It can actually work. It works really well for a small number of politicians or celebrities where you try to protect their, I wouldn't say identities, but you're trying to protect them on the internet. But it doesn't scale beyond that.
Right.
The advantage of our approach, with all due respect to my friends at Berkeley, is that we scale.
It's universal.
Exactly. It's one model that works really well for a very large number of people, because we don't tend to model each person independently.
Right.
We look for inconsistencies through time.
Okay. Yeah. But that, I think that's interesting, because I do like there's a little bit of that trigger sometimes when you see certain fake videos that for me now I've been studying the Uncanny Valley for a long time, but there's like something's not quite right. I don't know what it is, but something's not quite right.
Yes, doesn't feel right.
Yes. So, and that's sort of what always triggers it with me. But there's at a certain point, the content is so compelling that you let that disbelief go a little bit. Yes. What are some of the things that people can do to like say, okay, let's say you're watching a video of something and you're like, what are some of the things that people can do personally to say, hey, you know what? That's probably a fake. Beyond your filter, like what are things that people can look for in a video? And it's like, look at this, like look at the eyes, look at the mouth. What are some of the things that people can you visually identify beyond using a filter that would, a tool that can do it? What can you do in your own head?
So I can mention a couple of things on top of my head.
Right.
One of them is sort of using your own knowledge about a specific person. So for example, there is a really famous video for, I think they replaced Trump's face with Mr. Bean.
Right.
That's a really famous video.
Right.
And you look at it, it actually looks visually pretty good.
Right.
But you don't feel right about it. Exactly because of the uncanny valley that you mentioned.
Right.
It just doesn't feel right because of your own knowledge about this specific person. He doesn't talk or move his eyes or head that way.
Okay.
This is the problem now that people who create deepfakes still have. It's the uncanny valley. Yes, we can create something that visually looks pretty good.
Right.
But it doesn't feel right.
Okay.
This is where they still sort of come short.
Yeah.
So this is one thing. You use your own background and experience or knowledge about a specific person to figure out if the video actually is natural or not.
Right.
The uncanny valley is the whole idea about uncanny valley is about the naturalness of the video.
Okay.
Right. So this is one thing. The other thing, which is sort of a capability in pretty much all video players now, is slow down the video. You don't have to play the video at 30 frames per second.
Okay.
Slow it down a little bit and look for inconsistencies.
Okay.
Do the eyes move in consistent ways?
Okay.
There is actually a really also interesting sort of shortcoming of these methods now, sometimes they have what we like to call semantic inconsistencies,
okay,
which might not be really clear in deepfakes. I'll give you another example in a moment. But what I mean by semantic inconsistencies is that sometimes they create one blue eye and one brown eye. So this is a semantic inconsistency. This doesn't really exist in deepfakes. Because okay. deepfakes, as I mentioned, do you take the whole face and replace the face of another person
right.
or manipulate the facial expressions?
Right.
But in terms of generally speaking about multimedia misinformation or image misinformation, there is actually a sort of parallel big problem now where you can actually create faces of people who do not even exist.
Right.
There is a really famous website called thispersondoesnotexist.com where you can continuously generate images of people who don't even exist.
Right.
And that's actually a big problem, which is even from a computer vision perspective, from an artificial intelligence perspective, it's even harder to detect than deepfakes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, because you literally have one frame. It's just one image.
Right.
You need to figure out if that image is true or not from one image.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a much harder problem than deepfake right. detection.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. Yeah. Okay. So hold on. I had another question about okay. So I do want to talk about just generally the idea of using deepfakes for good things and or ideas that could be better. Right. Mm-hmm. So right around the time that right after, I think it was almost hours after we did our panel at the in Vegas, there was an article that came out. I think it was in Esquire about someone who did not like the de-aging that was happening for The Irishman, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
And they created a deepfake version of the de-aging instead.
Oh, interesting. I haven't seen that one.
Oh, I'll have to show it to you.
Okay, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was, I had a bit of an issue with the de-aging in The Irishman. Not that I thought it was particularly bad. I think what ILM did was very interesting. I think they have really good techniques to do it. It was based on actual, you know, CG face replacement mm-hmm. as opposed to 2D manipulation that can happen in some of the other methods. But the problem I have was in terms of the narration of the story is that they took someone that was 70 plus years old and they de-aged them to about 50 years old. But then they used that same age pretty much throughout the entire film, which was 3.5 hours, right?
Yes.
So you never, Robert De Niro never looked like he was 30.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But in the deepfake one, they did make him, they basically trained it on, you know, Taxi Driver when he was 30, and okay. he looked like he was 30.
Yes.
Right? But, and the video is very compelling. It's like, oh, he definitely looks a lot more like Robert De Niro when he's 30. Although, there were several issues that I had that I think were interesting. One was that they selected areas or parts of the film to show that where he wasn't necessarily moving too much, because then it would work, because there's certain body language of someone that's in their 70s that's not different than body language of someone in their 30s. Mm-hmm. So if he's not moving too much, there's not as much inconsistency. But if he's walking and stuff, a 70-year-old man does not walk like a 30-year-old man, right?
Correct.
So there's a lot of inconsistencies there. But the other one, obviously, that was interesting to me because of my study of digital humans is that the ILM version was very good at creating an incredible amount of detail information in the face because they tried to retain as much textural detail and all that stuff.
But wrinkles, yeah.
But then the deepfake one, I thought, was more successful at creating the proper face shape, but not as good at creating the texture.
Correct.
So what are those limitations? Like, obviously there's a limitation in creating sort of the micro detail in deepfakes. And why do those limitations exist, and how are they going to get better, and how?
In terms of whether they will get better, I can assure you they will get much better and really quick.
Okay.
I would say even my good friend Hao expects that this will get really much better within a year or so.
Okay.
So whether how, I don't exactly know how that will happen.
Right.
I am sure somebody will from the contingent generation community will come up with a more sophisticated deep neural network that creates these sort of fine-grained details.
Right.
That I don't know how that will happen.
Well, the limitation right now is the amount of memory you have on a GPU.
Exactly. Like, yeah. You know? So the main limitation right now,
yes,
is that most of the work is done at very low resolutions because of the amount of memory, as you mentioned, on the GPU.
Right.
Everything needs to be moved from the CPU to the GPU to do all the processing in terms of the deep neural network, and then you bring it back to the CPU.
Right.
So my assumption is that in the next, I don't know, a couple of years at most, NVIDIA will come up with another GPU with much bigger memory.
Right.
So that's from the hardware side.
Right.
From the algorithm side, someone will come up with a really sophisticated neural network that actually
much more efficient,
right. Memory efficient, and it can produce these fine-grained details.
Right.
Yes. So whether it will happen or not, I this is what I also mentioned on the panel.
Right.
Get on the train. AI will work, and will work much better than it is now.
Yeah. Right. So this is, basically, this is a form of AI, right? It's,
yes,
an artificial intelligence,
yes,
system. But the thing that's interesting about, you know, these ideas of what these deepfake things do is that they are all based on knowledge that it already has. So it only can really work based on things that it already knows.
I wouldn't really say things that we already know.
Right.
It's basically data driven.
Right.
And
but that data is an existing thing.
Exactly.
Right.
So it really depends on things we know, as you said, mm-hmm, but sort of indirectly through data.
Right.
So the whole premise of deep neural networks is that we learn from data. We don't handcraft features or handcraft algorithms. You have a whole bunch of data and you learn from data.
Right.
That's the whole premise.
Okay. So, yeah. But... all right, that's very interesting. I find it fascinating. Obviously, I've been looking at a lot of these ideas, and there's more to it, right? There's detection of images that are happening right now. There's also audio manipulation that's starting to happen at this point. Is it a very similar thing in the audio world? I don't know how much you know about the audio problems as well that are going on, where people can actually learn how someone speaks,
yes,
and then type out sentences and have that person say it as if they were saying it for real.
Correct. I'm not an audio expert, but
right,
I have seen a couple of demos from some colleagues at Google.
Right.
They have really sophisticated technology that basically you give it text input,
right,
and say simulate how Chris will have said.
Right.
That
and there's
sentence.
Plenty of audio from my podcast that they can learn from, right?
Exactly. From movies.
Right.
They did in The Irishman for Robert De Niro can be done for Robert De Niro from his previous movies.
Right.
You just extract audio, you learn how Robert De Niro speaks,
right,
and you recreate his audio from,
yeah,
text.
Yeah. Okay. But okay, so you mentioned there's some good things that can happen from this technology. You mentioned the idea of, you know, they needed to recreate Paul Walker for the specific movie. Now there are people that have ethical issues with that in itself. But
yes,
what are your feelings about that idea of recreating actors or that have passed on or things of that nature? What is your concept in that idea there?
I don't want to really take an ethical, I don't want to start to discuss this from an ethical perspective because I think it's a really complicated thing,
yes,
and it has different perspectives. I really think it's, as I mentioned on the panel, I really think it has to do with contracting and legislation.
Right.
If an actor gives permission or through his contract to a studio to create new episodes for a given show or something from him, and he gets paid, there is nothing wrong with that.
Right.
As long as you're protecting the workers' right. That's,
right,
I think this is the most important thing. In terms of recreating actors who have died or something, again, I don't want to to take an ethical stance about this.
Right.
It has to do with the agreement of the between the studio and his state or right. something like right. that. So I really think it. We are at a point now where we really need to think a lot about things like freedom of speech, government intervention in things like that, contracting, legislation, all of these. The problem, Chris, is that AI literally took everybody by storm in the last 8 years, since 2012 or something like that.
Yeah.
Not just us researchers, but the entire society. Mm-hmm. And we need to really think fast about how we should handle these ethical issues, if you will.
Right. Yeah, because couldn't, for example, right, it's very famously, you know, what is the lie detection, for example, yes. right? Lie detection has been famously flawed for a long time. And a lot of people who actually know with the one where you put your, they measure your pulse and all that stuff, famously is like, it doesn't really work. Mm-hmm. But the idea that it might work is what scares people into saying the truth, right? Correct. So it doesn't actually, you could actually lie and it won't really detect it in a lot of ways. But wouldn't you be able to do, using similar concepts of what you know, of your system, training a video to learn when someone is lying and someone's not lying, couldn't you basically try to use an algorithm similar to yours as a lie detection concept?
This is actually really interesting. It takes me back to 1997.
Okay.
Where I was still a graduate student and we sort of worked on a really early version of lie detection from videos.
Oh, really?
And the whole idea is it's very similar to what you see in movies. You detect the eyes, you detect the pupil and irises, and you see basically how these dilate and get bigger and smaller based on certain questions.
Right. And like in Blade Runner at the beginning.
Exactly. Yes. And I think if I remember correctly, in 1997, when we worked on that project, mm-hmm. when I was a graduate student, I think we used some of the Nixon videos to show that he was actually lying. You can tell from his videos that
could he you was do that today lying. On current presidents?
Well, we could do that. I don't want to go there,
right?
Because I don't want your audience to hate me.
No.
but if we have a large amount of data, I don't think it will be technologically hard problem.
Right.
To train lie detectors, a deep neural network to give you a score from 0 to 1 to say this person, how much we think that this person is actually lying.
Is telling the truth, right.
Yes, based on just his facial expressions, eye movements, pupil dilation.
Right.
Even analyzing the frequencies in his audio, things like that. Yeah, I think this could be relatively easy. I think it's actually an easier problem than detecting deepfakes.
Yeah.
Detecting lying is easier than detecting deepfakes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. But I do remember, it's funny because I do remember a very funny episode of Seinfeld when they were trying to use a lie detector on Jerry, and George Costanza, who's a famous liar, and he goes, I have knowledge of one of the best liars in the world. And he looks at him and he goes, remember, Jerry, it's not a lie if you believe it.
If you believe it, yes. I love that episode, yeah.
And so it's interesting. It's like, okay, how do you do that? Because I think, you know, obviously we, in a sense, you know, this is a good example. If we actually think about the fact that when us as a species, we learn if someone's lying based on all of our knowledge of seeing people lie or not lie.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So we have created our own deep neural network,
exactly,
of detecting lies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And again, this is what I was mentioning earlier. The whole idea of deep neural networks and artificial intelligence is that we learn from data.
Right.
Give me a big data set. For people who are lying versus not lying.
Right.
And I can train a neural network. I think it will do a pretty good job.
Right.
Again, nothing in AI is 100%.
No.
We will always have false positives and false negatives. But I think if you give me a reasonably sized amount of data, I can train a neural network to detect lying, including...
Right.
Presidents.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. That's a really great great idea. So which is basically brings up the idea of what I try to explain to people sometimes about, you know, AI and the and deep neural networks, and we can use it for many things, not just faces, obviously, for many, many things are being used using this technology. What it's interesting about it is what people like about it, mostly in the computer graphics world, like even, you know, audio compression uses deep networks to, mm-hmm. to do that as well, is that it's not actually a truth that it's giving you. It's giving you a best educated guess.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
And the advantage is that it can create the best educated guess faster than giving you the actual truth.
Faster and actually even more accurate than humans and in many
right.
cases. Yes.
Right, right, right.
Correct.
So I think that's a really fascinating idea about that. So listen, we're actually pretty close to an hour, and I want to make sure is that you can tell us about any other things that you think people would be interested in finding out about what kind of area of research you're doing and where people can follow some of this stuff.
So here's something that you'll be pretty much the first person to know this.
Okay.
So we created our first generation of deepfake detectors back in June. This is where we published the paper in yeah. Long Beach.
Yeah.
In a week or two, we are releasing our second generation of deepfake detection algorithm.
Right.
It actually works much better than before.
Oh, okay.
And I have now support from USC Administration and Information Sciences Institute where I work for creating a service very soon, hopefully before.
A service
where you can somebody actually can submit a video and we will return what we think of as a forensic evidence.
At scale. Right.
To say whether this video is fake or not.
Wow.
And we're trying to deploy the service and release it as soon as possible because we know that this is election year.
Right.
So that's something that this is the first time I say this to anybody.
Great.
So, yeah.
Well, that's perfect because this podcast will come out several weeks from now.
Yes.
So hopefully you'll be able to get a link at that point to talk about it.
Yes.
But basically you're giving away you're not giving away how you make that tool.
We're not releasing the source code again,
right.
again, because
right.
we decided, my team and I decided a while ago that it's not ethical to release the source code.
Right.
Because people who like to generate deepfakes for non-ethical purposes, for spreading misinformation, can use our technology to improve their creation technology. So we decided we're not going to release the source code. But
right.
we're creating a service that will be available to the public.
Right. But they can still create something and say, let's run it through the service, see how good our stuff is, and then let's make it better and see
of course.
How... Right.
Yes.
But
yes.
they can't actually do it to say, like, let's reverse engineer this to make
correct.
It faster, right?
Yes, correct. But in terms of reverse engineering, we are still academics. We will publish a paper.
Right.
If somebody is interested in sort of implementing our method, he or she can.
Right.
We're just trying to make it just a notch harder.
Right.
But we cannot keep hiding.
But honestly speaking, do you think even fake videos, I mean, fake or not, even real videos, sometimes people don't believe them or don't believe them. They people are so ground into their belief about whatever they're believing in because
correct.
Of the echo chamber. That's a great, I never heard of that term, but that's great. The echo chamber is like you reinforce your idea because people keep echoing your idea.
Correct.
So even fake or not fake, people aren't going to care sometimes, right?
I agree with you.
Yeah.
But I think there will be sort of a tipping point where everybody gets sick of this and start using a tool to
right.
tell them whether they are really being manipulated by someone or not. So, again, I don't know how people would be willing to use our service. We're creating a tool and we're putting it out there. I hope people will start using it.
Right.
I cannot control how people, what people will do.
So a classic example, I was, you know, someone had put something in information up there. And I said that I don't think that's correct. And then I found a Snopes article that said this isn't correct. That person replied like, "Snopes is bias."
Yes. Yes.
And I was like, "Nope, that's not real." It's like, but the whole point is that they're giving you facts.
Facts. Fact checking is not bias.
Yes, fact checking apparently is bias if it goes against your beliefs.
Yes.
Right. So, yeah. Do you think that people could look at your tool and say, that's bias.
Absolutely.
Right.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
People who love, people who love the current president, if we show a manipulated video of the current president,
right,
will probably hate us. People
right.
who do the same thing with Obama might actually hate us.
Right.
You cannot do something in technology and make sure that everybody is happy.
Right.
We are creating a tool. One of the things that I'm seriously concerned about is the amount of heat we're expected to get, but we're willing to take the heat.
Right.
We totally understand this is election year. Our democracy has been tampered with yeah. 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And we want to try our best to not make this happen again.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think, well, I'm glad you're doing it. I think you're right, too. We do have a responsibility because the internet is technically a functioning anarchy in some way, yes. that we have a responsibility to police ourselves, right? And
correct.
So I think that that's a good thing that you're giving people tools to allow that to happen, right? So,
correct. And yeah. I really think that it's an ethical responsibility. I'm a big advocate of freedom of speech. I am totally against government interference or
right.
regulating social networks, etc.
Right.
Because it's a slippery slope.
Yep.
Once you get on it, you don't know how it will end,
yep.
and we don't want that to happen.
Right.
I really think that it's everybody's responsibility to police each other, create technology from my perspective as an academic or a researcher, create technology. People who are in education should educate kids how to share content and on social networks. So everybody should play a role in this.
Okay. Well, it does bring up a point because now you said what you did about freedom of speech. There are, for example, California is trying to make up a law that's making it illegal to make deep fakes, right? So, or something of that nature. There are states that are trying to say, we should make this outlaw this idea. I mean, that's, you know, I was joking. It's like, that's like trying to take pee out of a pool. You can't.
That would be hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not just create a law that if you actually infringe on somebody's right? For example, one of the big problems with deepfakes is, which we haven't touched upon in this podcast.
Is revenge porn.
Yeah, exactly. Revenge porn. You don't have to create a law that says don't create deepfakes because there are some good uses of deepfakes.
Right.
Just create a law that if I find out that you created the deepfake as a revenge porn for Scarlett Johansson or something,
right.
you will be punished.
Right.
We will hunt you down and punish you.
Right.
That will be enough of a deterrence to people who use deepfakes for something like that.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So again, freedom of speech is a really slippery slope, and I probably told you this after the panel.
Yeah.
I am an Egyptian American, as you
right.
mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
I come from the Middle East.
Yeah.
And I value freedom of speech more than you can imagine.
Yeah, I bet
freedom
you do.
Freedom of speech is a slippery slope, and
yeah.
we have to really protect it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, I believe that. I think it's very, very important. I 100% agree with it. I think that I have just as much right to say the things I do as someone who I completely disagree says things.
Exactly.
That, right? And that's the thing that makes this... Technically, that's the thing that makes this country great, and the fact that we have been segregating different speeches just through social networks has actually been a little bit disturbing to my point, because we've actually lacked a conversation anymore.
Exactly. And I want to add something to your point. You made a great point that you have the right to say whatever you want, the
right.
same as other anybody's right to say whatever
they want. Right.
I want to add that it's your responsibility to defend their right to say whatever they want.
Yes.
And it's their responsibility, not just right, it's their responsibility to defend your right to say whatever you
yes.
want. This is how democracy works. Otherwise, it's not going to be funny.
No. It's good. It's good.
Yeah.
Well, that's an excellent way to put it. So thank you so much for doing this. This has been
pleasure.
An incredible podcast. Lots of information. I think people are just going to eat it up. But this is great.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.